Accession number 16356, reel 1.
Mr. Marshall, reel 1. Where were you born?
I was born in Hampstead in London.
Which year was this?
1922.
What did your father do for a living?
At the time he was a groundsman on a lawn tennis club, because during World War One he'd been gassed twice and he needed to do an outdoor job. That was at St John's Wood.
Did you go to school in Hampstead?
I went to school in Regent's Park, in that area.
How old were you when you left school?
I was 14 when I left school.
Did you get a job when you left school?
Yes, I did. I went to work for the post office as a messenger boy.
What were you doing when war broke out?
I was still a messenger boy, because I was 17 at the time.
And what was your reaction if and when you heard Chamberlain make the announcement declaring war on Germany?
It was quite exciting for me, I think, at the time. And then we went for a ride on our bikes and went towards Windsor and saw lots of barrage balloons going up in the sky. This was when they thought there were going to be air raids immediately the war started.
Were you in any of the bombing of Britain by the German Air Force?
Yes, I was, yeah.
Can you describe what happened to you personally?
Well, we lost several houses in the road near where we lived, in Kenton at that time, in Harrow. And where my fiancée at that time lived in Harlesden in London, there was severe damage there. And I was working in Camden Town, and there was a tremendous amount of bombing going on round there. In fact, the post office asked us to sleep in the sorting office at night so that we would be on hand to deal with incendiary bombs.
Did you have to deal with any personally?
No, we avoided it. But in the morning sometimes there was lots of glass all over the place, but we didn't actually have an incendiary on the sorting office.
Which street did you live in Kenton?
Stretfield Road.
Do you remember the address?
163.
And whereabouts on the road were the houses hit?
About 100 yards away, I should think, at... there was a roundabout just along the road joining Culver Grove.
Where were you when the bombs hit?
I was in my house in the we had, I think it was called a Morrison shelter, which was like a steel table in the room. And we went out to where this pair of semi-detached houses had been destroyed, see if we could get the people out, but they were all dead in the house.
Did you find the bodies?
No, we didn't, but the rescue services found them.
Were you pulling rubble away?
Yes.
With your bare hands?
Yeah, there was nothing else. We didn't have gloves or anything.
What did you find at the site of the bombed houses?
What did we find?
Any particular things you found?
No, it was just very strange, because the roofs of the houses seemed to be down on the ground. You know, that the whole of the structure had gone and seen the house was almost levelled.
So it had fallen straight down?
Yeah.
How frightening had it been in the Morrison shelter?
Well, it's frightening when you hear the bombs falling, because you never expect that one is aimed at you. One morning I was cycling from Kenton to Camden Town around about 4:30 in the morning, and I was going over a hill, and I heard this aeroplane come along and a bomb dropping, and jumped off my bike and sort of laid on the grass, but the bomb fell on Colindale Station that morning and killed lots of people in the station.
Did you go to the site of Colindale Station?
No, I carried on and went to work.
Which of the three areas do you think got bombed the worst? Kenton, Camden Town or Harlesden?
Oh, Camden Town.
Whereabouts did the bombs fall there?
Well, they were everywhere at St Pancras and all around Euston. There was a tremendous amount of damage in that area.
How do you think public morale stood up in London during the Blitz?
It seemed very good, really, because people had to get used to it, because otherwise we would have not been able to do any work at all. The raids sort of went on day and night, and if you didn't carry on, unless it was absolutely essential to go in shelters, then nothing would have been done.
What did you think to the work of the emergency services?
Oh, that was very good. I saw firemen up the top of turntable ladders in Tottenham Court Road in the Blitz, right over the top of buildings that were blazing away, and then the ladders would get damaged by the bombing and crumple up.
Was there any hatred of the air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
Well, you didn't seem to regard it as that, except that when I became a member of the air crew, we found there were lots of air crew were from London, so it might have been some way of trying to get your own back, as it were, by being able to bomb the enemy.
Did you listen to Churchill's speeches at that time?
Yes.
What effect did they have?
Well, they were very stirring speeches, and they did encourage you.
And Lord Howell?
Yes, we did listen to him, yeah. But we thought that was more amusing than threatening to us.
Now, can you tell me how you came to be in the RAF, please?
Well, I was called up with my age group. And initially you had to go and register and select which service you wish to go into. And having said RAF, and then they asked you if you wanted to fly or work on the ground crew, so I said I would like to fly. And then I was sent to the RAF selection board at Euston House, which is near Euston Station in London, and there we had a medical and an intelligence test, and as a result of that I was told I would be on deferred service as a wireless operator air gunner. And then I kept getting letters from the RAF saying, we haven't forgotten you. And after a while, I got a letter saying that they've now got a new trade in our crew called a flight engineer, which is a flying fitter. And they were seeking people to remuster into this trade. And I thought, well, I think I would like to do that. So I responded positively, and within a couple of weeks I was called up. So then I went to Padgate initially, just to be kitted out with uniform. And then we were transferred to Redcar in Yorkshire, where we did some initial training. And because I think we were required rather urgently, our initial training was cut short. We got as far as being able to march up and down and salute somebody and look at a rifle, and didn't really learn much about it. And then we were sent to RAF Cosford to do a flight mechanics course. The intention was that we would work then at the end of that course as flight mechanics on an airfield and learn the job. But again, the urgency was pretty desperate, so they sent us immediately following that course onto a fitter 2E's course to learn the fitter's part of aircraft engines. And then we were supposed to work as fitter 2Es, but that again didn't happen. And we found ourselves on what they called the flight engineers course proper. But they didn't really know how to go about our training then, because we were the first course to go from civilian life to become flight engineers. So most of our training was in theory and in all classroom stuff. And we spent quite a long time at Avro's factory near Manchester, learning all about the Lancaster, which was the aircraft that I'd been selected for. And by the end of our course, we knew everything about the Lancaster aeroplane. What would happen if certain parts were damaged on the engine, how we would know and what to do about it. And at the end of... Oh, we did a short gunnery course at Pembrey, but throughout all these courses we didn't get to flying in an aeroplane. Everything was done on the ground. Finally we qualified as flight engineers, and they gave us a sergeant's rank and a little flying badge, a half a wing with an E in it. And we were then sent to what they called a heavy conversion unit, where the pilot and the remaining members of the crew had previously been flying on Wellingtons. They hadn't done operational flying, but they'd been doing training flights on Wellington bombers. And because changing from a two-engine to a four-engine aircraft meant heavier handling, the whole crew had to go to this conversion unit. The method of getting us into a crew was they put all the flight engineers into a room, and then the door opened at the other end of the room and in came all the pilots, and they just said, pick yourself a partner. So a big Australian chap came up to me and he said, I think we would make a good pair. So I became part of his crew, which had three Australians in it. There was the pilot, the navigator and the bomb aimer. The remaining members of the crew, the mid-upper gunner and myself were from London, and the rear gunner and the radio operator were from Scotland. So the first aeroplane we flew in wasn't a Lancaster at all, it was a Halifax. And the reason for that was that the Halifax had a much stronger undercarriage, because initially the pilots sort of brought these aeroplanes in very heavily and one-sided, and I think the first takeoff and landing that I did, we actually bounced about 30 feet in the air. And we, for that reason, I knew nothing about the Halifax with its fuel systems and everything. So we had an instructor for the pilot and an instructor for the engineer. And after about 4 or 5 circuits, landing and taking off and landing, we were then left on our own with this Halifax. And we weren't too long on the Halifax, and then we picked up the Lancasters and started our training on those. I can't remember quite how long we were at the conversion unit, but because we had three members of the crew who were Australians, we were sent to the Australian squadron, 460 squadron, at Binbrook, which was near Grimsby.
This is in October 1943?
Yeah. Around about the beginning of October.
How did you find the Australians as compared with the British and their attitude to flying and the war?
Oh, they were very good and very friendly people. In fact, we had two officers in our crew who really didn't wish to go into the officers' mess. They always said, "We'll come back to your mess if we went out in the evening." We always went out as a crew together. And when we got back to our units, we just went for a final drink in our mess.
Did they have a different way of going on from the British?
Yes, they didn't seem to regard themselves in the same way as British officers did. You know, they didn't seem to be aloof in any way at all.
What kind of reception did you get on the squadron?
Oh, we had a good reception on the squadron, because their one aim in life was to get you operational. We were introduced to the commanding officer on the day we arrived, and he said, "It's a bit late to get you on ops today, but we'll have you on tomorrow." And that's what happened, actually. Because we were a new crew, we didn't have our own aircraft, we had to use spare aircraft. And our first operational flight was to Munich. We used to get some idea of where you were going by the amount of fuel that was going to be in the aircraft. So we knew we were going for a long flight. In fact, that return to Munich took something like 7 hours 55 minutes, I believe.
So you were more or less thrown in at the deep end.
We were thrown in at the deep end. We, they told us that we, all our crew were considered above average in training, and we were destined for Pathfinder Force. So we went as a crew on the first operational flight, and we were accompanied by an experienced pilot, a squadron leader, came with us. In fact, he occupied my so-called seat in the aeroplane, and I stood up all the time.
What happened on this operation?
On that operation, we were in what they called the first phase. The multi-bomber raids were worked out in phases, and if you were in the first phase, it appeared that you were comparatively lucky because the enemy hadn't found out where you were going by that time. And so we did our bombing mission satisfactorily. When we came back, we were getting low on fuel. In fact, part of my job was to compute how much fuel we'd got left. Every 20 minutes, we had to work out how much fuel we'd got. And when we got back and we were making our landing, our fuel gauges were empty. That's what the gauges told us. But I knew we'd got a bit more than that, so we attempted to land, and because we were landing on a crosswind, the pilot was unable to make a successful landing, so we had to go round again, which meant 40 gallons of fuel. Every time he took off, it was 40 gallons. And he made two unsuccessful attempts at landing that night. And I said, you better get it in next time because we haven't got very much fuel left now. So he was successful a third time. But we found when they dipped the tanks, we'd got 10 gallons left altogether, so we wouldn't have made it the third time.
What was the result of that raid? Was much damage done, or many aircraft?
Yeah, we understood that was successful. There were, I think, 9 losses on that.
It says here in your logbook, 9 aircraft missing.
Yeah. That was 9 out of probably about 400 or 500.
Did you see any planes come down?
Yes. Yes. But you didn't think it was ever going to happen to you. You know, it's like thinking you're never going to be run over.
Did you know what the target was?
Well, the target was just Munich, generally. There was no specific part of it.
And how did you feel after this operation?
Well, personally, I felt all right, except... Yes, I did. I seemed to be quite calm in my own mind. I was all right. Our mid-upper gunner was the only chap in the crew who smoked, and he wasn't able to smoke on this flight, and he seemed quite all right in the aeroplane until he got out of it. And then he was desperate for a cigarette, and he started trembling, because he was relying on his cigarette. But nobody else showed any signs at all. He was the youngest member of our crew. He was about 17, 18 at the time.
I'm surprised that such youngsters went on raids.
Yeah, they did.
What happened after this raid? I think your next one was 7th of October when you went to Stuttgart.
Yes, I think we should have gone on another one, but the aircraft we were supposed to pick up from somewhere else had a had a defect on an engine which caught fire as we were taking off, and so we couldn't go on that one. Then we were briefed for something else, and the weather turned sour on us, and like the cloud was going to be too dense, so we didn't go there. And then we went to Stuttgart, and there again we were in the first phase. So that was okay, but there were lots of clouds over Stuttgart, so we didn't really see a lot there.
Then we come to the raid in which you were shot down, 8th of October. Can you describe that in detail, please?
Yes, we prior to that raid, we'd been having some discussions on aircraft crashing on takeoff, and we'd been told that we, because the type of aircraft we were using were Lancasters built in Canada under license, and they had Rolls-Royce Packard engines, and there was a different system of carburation and things on this aeroplane which relied on pneumatic pressure. And we were told that it was thought that aircraft were crashing because of lack of air pressure, where you could have a situation where your engines were actually in the engine off position, the switches, and as your pressure built up, the engines would switch off because they needed air pressure to operate the switches. So we were told if we had a long taxi round to take off and used a lot of brake pressure, then we shouldn't take off. So that night we had a 4,000 pound bomb, 1,000 pounds, and the rest of the space is filled with incendiary bombs. The 4,000 pound bomb had a 144 hour delay fuse on it, which I think is about 6 days. The taxi circuit round to the takeoff position was almost entirely round the airfield, and we were following each other round, so we used lots of brakes so you didn't crash into the one in front. And by the time we got to our position to take off, our pneumatic pressure was right down to zero. So I told the pilot we couldn't take off. So, because he tells the control tower we can't take off, and the little girl in the control tower, a WAF in there, she said, why? So he said, why to me? And I said, we've got no brake pressure. So we send the message back, no brake pressure, and the WAF said, are you impeding takeoff? Yes, right, take off. So we're taking off, we're rumbling down the runway and building up speed and building up this air pressure as well, because the units that make the air pressure build up are attached to engines. And we're thinking all the time, we've got these 7,000 pounds of bombs on here, all the fuel, and we're going to crash any minute. And then when the pilot's taking off, because all the propellers are turning clockwise, the tail of the aeroplane tends to slew round to the left or to the port, and he has to correct that before he asks for full power.